Hi, this is Alan Chartog, and this is a very special occasion here at WAMC. We're speaking to Joe and Carol Rich, who have done an extraordinary thing. They've started a school, and now two schools. And the name of their book that they've written is Getting to Bartlett Street, our 25-year quest to level the playing field in education. Joe and Carol, so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, Joe, let me start with you. Everybody on the other side of the microphone always wants to know who we're talking to. So let's get a little idea about who you are. What's your life been like so far?
Well, I was born in a middle-class family in Pittsburgh, and I went to public schools all through my education until I went to Cornell. And my family moved around a lot. And I ended up going to high school in Charleston, West Virginia. Most people don't think a lot about West Virginia, but it was the western counties of Virginia who seceded from the Confederacy and formed a state in 1863. They didn't do a very good job of it, and we ranked next to Mississippi as the worst state in education when I went there. And sadly, 90 years after the end of the Civil War, schools were still segregated in West Virginia. I somehow graduated from Charleston High School in 1951 at the age of 16 and entered Cornell.
Well, wait a second. That's pretty early, 16, isn't it?
Well, I was a good student, and every time the family moved, I got moved ahead a little bit. It was a mistake to go to school that young, I think.
But you're very smart, and everybody knows it. Okay. So, Joe, you have Parkinson's disease.
Yes, I do.
How has that affected your ability to do all the stuff you're doing?
Well, I've had wonderful medical care, and I wasn't diagnosed till I was in my mid-60s, and the disease tends to progress more slowly the older you are. And I find I don't have the energy and have problems sometimes speaking, but I'm just as tough as I ever was, and I'm going to fight this disease, the way we fought the bureaucrats and the blob, and to get things done right.
So at 16, you go to Cornell.
Yes.
Your parents have money?
No.
But how'd you get to Cornell?
I've been watching our grandchildren apply to college, and it's a quite different thing. I was born in 1934. That was the Depression. And, of course, every university wanted diversity, and diversity was hard to come by in West Virginia. So I think I was probably the only person in the state that applied to Cornell.
It's hard to believe that we represented diversity at this point in time.
Carol, explain that a little bit.
We were white, middle-class kids, and we represented diversity because it was geographic.
Well, we're going to get to you in 1 second, but give us a little preview before we go back to Joe and tell us where you were from.
I was from the Middle West. I was from Chicago, Illinois. And when I got to Cornell, I think they thought I was a little odd. Probably I was. They would come into my room, and I apologize to all New Yorkers when I do this, but what they would say to me was, "Talk. We want you to talk. You talk funny." And I guess I did talk funny. So I represented a kind of linguistic and geographic diversity.
And from a religious profile, what are you guys?
I had no idea what they were talking about. We're Jews, but they came in and asked me, was I a Galicianer or a Litvak? And I knew enough about statistics that I had a 50% chance of being wrong, so I cried.
And when you cried, then what happened?
They stopped asking me because they knew I didn't know what they were talking about.
That's funny. Okay, so I take it we're getting to the point where we realize, maybe inadvertently, that you guys met at Cornell. Is that right?
Yes.
That is.
I have to tell you that as a 16-year-old hillbilly freshman in a school where there were four men or boys for every girl,
that was a good thing.
It wasn't much fun for the first 2 years. But in October of my junior year, my roommate said his girlfriend had a friend that would be just right for me. And I was fixed up on a blind date with this girlfriend's roommate. on October 7th, 1953.
Only you would remember the date.
I'm impressed.
At that,
I don't remember my anniversary.
I don't remember anything.
Yeah.
Backwards. And at that moment, when he came to the dorm, there was a power failure, which I've always tried to turn into a metaphor and couldn't. So we met in total darkness. He couldn't see me, and I couldn't see him.
It's extraordinary.
And we got outside, and then I did see him. And I've been looking for 57 years for a word to describe in English the feeling of what happened.
Chemistry.
Coup de foudre, a stroke of lightning. It was beshert. And after that...
You better translate for everybody else out there, Carol.
Beshert means that it was meant to be.
Uh-huh.
It's like when you find the good humor that you really love and you don't need to think about any other flavors.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Creamsicle. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
So that's what happened.
Okay, so we're going back to Joe for a minute now. So you majored in what?
Well, I spent the first 2 years in the School of Hotel Administration and had the misfortune to flunk plumbing in my sophomore year. So I then transferred into the liberal arts program and got a bachelor's majoring in economics. And I had this wonderful blind date in October of 1953. And for me, it was love at first sight. And we were married in 1955 after I graduated.
Did your parents all approve?
Carol's parents were not thrilled at their daughter marrying a penniless artist. That's what Carol's mother called somebody getting a liberal arts degree. I did have a secret weapon which enabled me to pull off the marriage, and that is her father had spent 6 years in the Navy before and during World War II. And when I told him I was going in the Navy, that won him over. And he allowed us to get married.
What made you go in the Navy? What year was this now?
This is 1955.
So the draft was still around. Everybody had to do military service.
Had to do military service. And I went to Navy Officers Candidate School. I suspect the Navy had some romance, more romance certainly than the Army, and it was going to get me my girl.
And can you remember your side of that story, Carol, in terms of what you remember about your parents and Joe?
Yes, I can. We went on this blind date because my roommate told me that Joe Rich was weird, and I was weird, and so I should probably go out with him. And when I went back to one of my high school reunions, one of my teachers was still alive, and she looked at me and she said, "Dear, if we'd had the word then, you would have been a nerd." Now, I was much slower than Joe. I didn't get to college till I was 17.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Terrible. Still a fish out of water.
Your major was?
I was a fine arts major.
Huh. Great.
That was going to be really useful.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that.
Now, you had this moment. Were you at all concerned about his going in the Navy and leaving you alone?
No.
Oh.
I thought it would be so romantic to leave the Middle West and get in a car and drive across the country that I wasn't old enough to have those kind of concerns.
Right. Didn't know better. Okay, so Joe, you come out of Cornell, you go to the Navy, and I take it that passes well for you?
Yes. We had some ups and downs during my naval career, but I did get out in 1958. And although Carol's father sanctioned our marriage, he said if he would no longer pay for her additional education. So Carol...
That's not quite fair. I could either get married or I could be educated.
Uh-huh.
Those were the two choices.
And that was sort of 1950-ish in
terms
of...
It was very 1950-ish. It never struck me that it was an insane thing to say to somebody. Yeah.
Well, but also somewhat sexist, right?
Somewhat? Yes.
That's great. Okay, Joe, out of the Navy.
So I wanted to go to business school, and I went to Stanford University because we thought at the time we were going to live on the West Coast where I had been in the Navy. And when I got out of business school, I wanted to go to work on Wall Street. And I was able to get a job with an exciting young firm, which had just been founded, called Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. And 7 years later, I was fired, along with a friend of mine. We were sort of the rabble-rousers there. And we wanted to push things along faster than the founders did. So we started our own firm called Rich and Tang.
Rich and Tang.
Tang, yes. At about the worst time one could, in late 1968, the stock market really stayed down for most of the 70s, and we were forced to improvise to stay alive. And in the course of doing that, we were one of the pioneers in something called a money market mutual fund. And that enabled a small saver to get the same high interest rates that the people with six figures could get. And there was a Federal Reserve regulation supported by the banks and the brokers limiting the interest paid to small savers. And this new product, the money market fund, helped the small saver earn as much as the big saver. And we ran into huge opposition from the defenders of the status quo in the financial industry. And I often thought later on when we were fighting the bureaucracy in education that it was no different than what we had faced in the financial industry. The defenders of the status quo were standing in the way of the little guy. So that always stuck with me.
Okay, let me just, for the people who are listening now, clarify this a little bit. Are you telling us that you and your partner were responsible in many ways for the money market fund?
We started, I think, the third fund to be started. There are now thousands of them.
Sure.
And we had an advantage over the Dreyfuses and Fidelities of the world in that we took a very bland name for our fund and called it the Daily Income Fund. So that meant any other intermediary, a broker or an investment counselor, had no fear of us coming back to compete for their customer. Whereas if they put Dreyfus's name on their product, Dreyfus was a competitor, or Fidelity was a competitor. So we found this little niche of serving other professional investors. And finally, after 10 years, the business began to take off in the late 70s. And by this time, Carol and I had three children.
Three daughters.
And by the mid-80s, I stopped for a minute and I said, wait a minute, I'm 50 years old. We've made more money than we ever dreamed about. And I was getting bored. What was I going to do for the rest of my life? And Carol, who hadn't finished school, Carol Friedman.
Carol Friedman Rich.
Cornell 57, decided to go back to college. And she became Dr. Carol Rich in 1986 at the age of 50.
Okay, let's stop right there for a second, Joe, and ask Carol to tell us what she did that in and how she did it.
There are two things that I think I would not recommend for marriage therapy. One is writing a book together, which was very difficult, and two is suddenly going back to school after being married for a very long time because it deflects your attention. It was very early in the game.
Was it in psychology?
It was in psychology. I'm a developmental psychologist. And it was in the era where the commercials on television showed, assumedly, a mother with a baby in her arm and a mop,
yes,
and a book held behind the baby. And we were called returning women as though we had been dead or something, and we suddenly came back to life and decided we wanted an education.
You know, as a lifelong professor, I can tell you this. Roselle, my wife, and I, both college professors, always knew that anybody who came back after having taken hiatus is going to be better than anybody who hadn't. Really, because they had their feet on the ground, they knew what they were doing. You used one Yiddish word before, I'll use another, sechel. There was a little bit of just wisdom that they had. And some of the hormonal issues were resolved by that time.
They were calmed down, and I was the only one in the graduate school who had children. So here was a whole department of developmental psychologists who had never handled a baby. So that was where my sechel came in. I knew what a baby was like.
Yeah, well, that's a great story. And you did well. Where'd you go?
I went to the Graduate Center of the City University.
Which is no easy place, that's for sure. There are some, you know, some graduate schools which, you know, one raises an eyebrow about, but not City University, which has
That was tough.
Tough, tough, tough place to be. So congratulations on
that. I can now walk in the building and not throw up with fear.
Listen, I went to NYU for mine, and I got to tell you, same thing.
Fear.
same thing, just plain fear all the time. That one person had the power to do you in.
That's right.
Okay, so Joe, you were going to leave us, as you said, at age 50 or so, you had made a lot of money. Now, there's little money, there's some money, there's a little bit more money. When you say a lot of money, are you talking about a lot of money? Are you talking about Madoff-type money?
No. Besides, that was crooked.
Yeah, that was crooked. No, but are you talking, I'm just talking about billions.
No, it was not billions, but it was enough that we had put away, we had sent our kids to college. We'd send them first to private school in New York, sent them to college. By the time Carol got her PhD in 1986, two of them had finished college, and the third one was I think, in her sophomore year. And I thought, I can't spend the rest of my life just chasing the dollar. I have enough of the dollars. I want to give something back. And I saw what Carol was doing. She became the first female president of the largest and oldest school for the deaf in New York.
Indeed.
And she was doing interesting work. And the measurement wasn't in dollars. It was in helping others and getting some satisfaction. So I guess I got a little jealous of her.
Do you really mean that, or are you just sort of saying that?
No, well, she talked about the struggles of a marriage during graduate school, but the benefit was she was doing really important work. And I one day was giving a presentation to get a new client, and I'd gotten pretty good at it, having done it for 20 years. And in the middle of it, I couldn't remember the name of the client or the size of the account. I was on autopilot. And that was terrible. And worse than that, we got the account. So I said, I need something different. So I made the decision to leave Rich and Tang. The satisfaction had gone from the money-making.
And what about Tang? Did you just walk into his office and say, you know, I'm done? How'd you do it? Carol said, in case you missed it, go ahead.
He had some very strong needs to be dominant, so he liked it when
you said, yeah,
I would leave. And it was an expensive decision. The timing, according to everybody who looked at it, was so horrible, they thought I was insane, because our firm was just going public, and if I had stayed there, I would have made a great deal more money. And I announced when we went public that I was leaving. And a friend called me and he said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I don't know, but I had to get out before I could think about the future. I don't know what I'm going to do. He says, not only is your decision a stupid one, you're not explaining it very well. So I thought for a moment and said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend a third of my time investing, a third of my time teaching, and a third of my time in philanthropy. And my friend said, that sounds like a really wonderful plan. And I didn't have much trouble with the investing part. And I got a job as an adjunct professor of finance at Columbia University. And I was pretty good at it, but I realized that many people could have taught that course. The thing I was having trouble with was finding something philanthropic where I wasn't just writing checks, but doing important work. And it so happened, out of the air at that time, there was an article in June of 1987 in the New York Times about a man named Gene Lang, who had graduated high school in the mid-30s. And he had been invited back to give a talk to his graduating class from grammar school. He was going to give a rah-rah speech and tell these kids, you work hard and everything will come to you. And he says he had an epiphany when he got up on the dais and he gave a completely different speech. And he said to these children who were living in great poverty, don't think you can't go to college. I'll provide you with a scholarship so you can.
If you graduate, if you get through, I'll supply you. And this made international headlines.
Yes, and Gene Lang is a great salesman. I call him the Pied Piper. When I read the article, I knew I'd found my philanthropic project. And I immediately called him on the phone, and several hours later, I was in his office. I told him of the horrible education I had in West Virginia and how children there could benefit from this I Have a Dream program. I still remember. He looked at me and says, you're moving back to West Virginia. I said, no, I'm never going back to West Virginia. We live in New York. And he said, Joe, this is a job. You're going to be working with these kids. It'll consume you. That sounded pretty good to me.
Our guests are Carol and Joe Rich, authors of a new book on their 25-year effort to level the playing field in education, entitled Getting to Bartlett Street. Okay, Joe and Carol, tell us why and how you decided to start a school.
I hate to have children's future denied to them. They had to have a choice. They had to be told who they were and what they would be able to do. And that was kind of the basis of the way we started the school.
So how hard was it to actually start a school? I mean, did you walk away from there and say, we got to start a school?
Yes.
Well, we thought we had to do something. And the next step up was to start a school. And so we started working on it.
But at what moment did you conceptualize that you needed to start a school? Was it a conversation between the two of you? How did you do it?
Joe came home one day and said, I think it'd be a good thing to do to start a public school. And I sort of held my breath because I didn't want to say, what are you, crazy? And I took him to see a lot of people I knew in education. I'd been working in a school for the deaf, so I knew quite a few people. And they all said, that's a really great idea. Go do it.
But then we talked to people who knew a little bit more about politics, and they said, they're never going to get it. Anything through the Board of Education. You can't work with them.
Were you guys basically early into charter schools?
There was no such thing as a charter school then. This was 1988. The first charter law passed in Minnesota in 91. First school opened in 92. And New York didn't get a charter law until the end of 1998.
So how is this going to work? You were going to pay for a regular public school.
We had a little bit of money, and then I'm going to jump ahead and end up at Pfizer, but they also offered us a little bit of money, and then we just...
This is the famous Pfizer chemical company.
Yes.
Right? Pharmaceuticals.
They gave us their old corporate headquarters, and that's a story in itself, which I could tell you in a minute, but we...
Go ahead, tell us.
We just had no idea what the risk was that we were taking. We had a good idea. We thought, well, people will support a good idea. Let's start a school where kids have a chance. So Joe had run Pfizer's pension plan. He was having lunch with them one day, one of them, and he said, let me bring you to see the CEO. They were doing an urban renewal, and the CEO said to the people around the table, I want this done. So when I look back at this and when I think about talking to you, we are just lucky people. Things happen that made possibility happen. And so Pfizer gave us their corporate headquarters. First, they gestured and said, here, take this. And I thought they meant the table. And I thought, well, you got to say thank you. That's what your mama told you to do. So I said, thank you very much for the conference table. And they said, no, we mean the 40,000 square foot building.
That was our first break in the effort to start a school. Because before that, we were talking to the district superintendent who wasn't going to let us start a school and wasn't going to leave any fingerprints on the decision. They just stalled. But when we came up with this building and went to the city and said, well, not only do you want to start a school, we have a 40,000 square foot building right in the neighborhood where we want to start and the support of this major corporation.
That was a different cup of tea.
Who were the politicians then who were in charge?
Of what?
Of the city. In other words, that would be helpful to you. Was the famous Joel Klein there yet?
No.
So
no, no.
Who were you dealing with?
We were six chancellors or five chancellors away from that.
Who were you dealing with?
At that moment?
Joe Fernandez.
Joe Fernandez.
Had just come to New York to be a chancellor. He'd come from Miami. And he got very excited about this building. And that's what made us think we had a chance. In fact, the I Have a Dream group had gone down to the White House. This was Bush 1. And Fernandez made a talk there, and he mentioned that we had this building and that we were offering it to the city and that we were going to start a school. That was about 2 years into our work where we'd gotten nowhere with the bureaucrats. And then it turned out Fernandez couldn't get anybody from his staff to go 1 mile down the road to look at the school. So then we escalated our efforts a bit and had a friend at the New York Times. He was an editor of the magazine page, and he introduced us to a reporter named Joe Berger, who came out and did a story on the school.
With a great photographer who did a piece of photojournalism of us standing in front of this wreckage that we had offered to turn into a school. And I think that was fairly powerful.
Can I ask how much money you guys had to put into this?
In the beginning?
Yeah.
$500,000.
$500,000 of your money to transform the building.
And $500,000 of Pfizer's.
And $500,000 of Pfizer's.
That didn't transform the building.
I was going to say.
It transformed one of the four floors.
Amazing. Amazing. Doesn't sound like so much. But what about some of the things we now take for granted about charter schools now? In those days, I mean, obviously you guys have feelings about unions, you have feelings about other things. Were you able to just say, okay, we're going to start this school, or did you have to fight for what was going to be in the school?
No, there was another one of those lucky breaks. I don't know how they happened, where we had put a union official on our planning board, and he told us how to do things and how to get things done. We had absolutely no idea what we were doing. And he was the one that guided us through all those rules.
Well, was it tough?
Yes.
But the union wasn't the problem. It was the bureaucrats. And the way they gave you trouble was they just didn't listen.
Or they would sit there in a room. We would be at a central table, and there would be about 20 people around the perimeter with big yellow legal pads. We thought they were writing something down. I think they must have been drawing pictures, because nothing ever happened after those meetings.
Okay, so just bring us up to date. What happened next in the story? You had this idea. You were meeting with these people. You had talked to Fernandez, the superintendent. When did it all come to fruition, and how did you get there?
When it showed up on the front page of the New York Times that two citizens wanted to give the city a school and were being denied the opportunity to do so.
The whole process took 4.5 years from when we started. The first break was getting the building, and then the New York Times article came 6 months later, and that infuriated Fernandez because it made him look bad.
He made him look bad because he couldn't get his people to do what they were supposed to do.
Right. And there were very difficult conversations with Fernandez and his staff. One thing we learned in this process, we sent him a fax There was no email at that time. And if you send a fax to a big bureaucracy, about 20 people see it before the addressee. So by the time Fernandez saw this fax, everybody in the building knew that we were sort of at war with him.
And one of his staff called us on a Friday night in Sheffield and just started...
Sheffield, Mass., where you live.
Yes, yeah. Started screaming at me. And I listened to this screaming for a while, and then I said, you know, I really can't hear you if you keep screaming like this, and besides, the Sabbath starts in 20 minutes. So could we please just get to the point of what you want me to do?
And what did they want you to do?
They wanted us to stop.
Stop doing your own publicity and your own...
Stop pushing.
Pushing. Okay, let's go on. What happened next?
I think the next battle we had was with zoning.
Yes.
They found a way to say that this was a commercial neighborhood. And you have to remember, Carol is a PhD in psychology. Sure. I knew something about business, but zoning laws, we didn't know anything about that. And that turned out to be a complete ruse. All that was required, as I remember, in the end was a letter.
Pfizer was paying lawyers $5,000 a week to figure out how to change this zoning, and all that was needed was a letter to the zoning board saying we wanted to change this from an industrial site to a school area, and we got a letter back in 2 weeks saying you're changed.
Now what happened?
Well, then you have to remember... It's very complicated, but at that time, the chancellor had authority only over the high schools. So it was bouncing back between Fernandez, who I think really wanted to get the school started.
This is an elementary school.
Yes, we were. My developmental psychologist wife, by this time, had convinced me that we had to start early. But Fernandez had to find a way to start this school over the objections of the District 14 bureaucracy. So we became part of Eastern District High School, which was one of the most dangerous, war-torn strife schools in...
It had one of the highest murder rates of the high schools in the city.
Let me just get this straight. In order to make this work, they were telling you you were part of the high school on paper, and therefore, you didn't have to report to the local elementary school authorities.
No, we had to report to the superintendent of high schools.
Yes, I got it.
And they put us in Eastern District with guards and little kids.
Yeah, okay. So,
that enabled
us a story. Go ahead.
Well, then we had this is a great bureaucracy story. We had a search committee. And fortunately, we got a great man named Noel Krifter, who was head of Brooklyn High Schools at the time, and he really wanted to make this work. And so we were on the search committee, which was a first, because we weren't part of the bureaucracy. And it ran very smoothly. We found exactly the person we wanted. We were ready to go, and so we had only one snag. She was a principal, and because we were made part of a high school, she had to become an assistant principal, which meant she had to take an exam to get a demotion. Only...
Did she do it?
Yes. First time she went, there was nobody in the room, so she went back home, and then they sent for her again, and they made her an assistant principal.
Did she have to take less money to do that?
Yes.
Why'd she do it?
Because this was a kind of school that she'd always dreamt about having.
What happened next after that? You now had your principal, you had your building, thanks to Pfizer. You guys were putting in $500,000. Pfizer was putting in $500,000. What happened next?
The borough president of Brooklyn, in the days when borough presidents still had discretionary funds, had probably been approached by Pfizer, and somebody called us and said, show up at Borough Hall. And we walked into Borough Hall, and he got up, Howard Golden, and said, Here's $2.75 million. So something again fell out of the sky.
We had made a big bet because the million was in the building, and it was going to cost, we thought, $5 million to finish it. And the Board of Ed authorized $2 million. So we were $3 million short when we went ahead and started, because we figured it was harder to stop a school than it was to start one. And then this miracle of Borough President Golden appeared.
Do we have any idea why he did it?
I think he was asked to do it.
By?
Pfizer.
Oh, Pfizer asked him. And it's a pretty good example of some of the better things that happen in politics when people with some wealth ask a politician to do something.
People with some wealth or people with a firm that pays a huge amount of taxes to the city. Mm-hmm. It wasn't us. I think it was Pfizer.
Yeah, no, I meant Pfizer. Yeah.
Yes, that's a very good example of it.
Yeah. Pfizer's plant, which was across the street from the building that became the school, I think was the largest manufacturing employer left in New York City. This is 1990.
And they made Viagra.
Very important. So now,
very important.
So now you guys had enough money to start the school. When did you start it?
September 1992.
Okay. You remember the day?
Yes.
I don't remember the number of the day, but...
Tell us about it.
I remember that these big, tough kids from Eastern District walked all our little kids down the street into the school so they would be safe. They had a phalanx of high school students on either side. I think one of the mistakes I made was not asking those kids to continue to help us. They went back to Eastern District after delivering our kids to the school.
And where did they come from, the kids?
They came from the neighborhood.
How did you do that? You advertised? You said anybody wants to go to the school, or how?
No, Sonia Gallardo, the principal, and I went from day school to day school, from daycare to daycare, advertising it. But our most powerful allies were the bodega owners. And we went and spoke to one on every block. And we had flyers, and they put the flyers up on the wall, and that's how it happened.
Was it tough to get enough students, or were they oversubscribed?
Oversubscribed.
And how did you decide who went?
We had a lottery.
Did you?
I decided that was the only fair way to do it, and I learned when I went to give a speech at Cornell, we had a stratified random sample. I wanted the demographics of the school to match the demographics of the neighborhood.
Were there those people who pushed you guys into getting their kid in because they had some clout?
That yes. Happened later.
I got two different answers. I got a
no,
yes.
No, the first year, we were trying to get 50 kids, 25 kindergartners and 25 first graders. And Carol and Sonia did that. But I don't think we had much demand beyond that. I mean, these parents were taking a big chance. The building wasn't finished. They had to start in this horrible Eastern District High School building. They didn't know we'd get it done we got it done, what, 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later? So these were pioneers, these parents.
I was afraid we would lose them when they saw the condition of the building into which their kids were going to go, which wasn't finished yet, and we had to take all the parents in wearing hard hats. And then that their kids had to go to Eastern District before they came into this building. I think it was evidence of how really desperate they were to try and get a chance for their kids.
You know, it sounds to me like your book may become a movie. Sounds great. So let me start to ask you about what we now know as the sort of public versus private debate. For those people who are not listening about charter schools are public schools. And it's a very important thing to remember. They're just a different kind of public school that we have. At what point did you guys get involved in the charter school movement?
Well, we had heard of it, and we knew there was no chance it would ever happen in New York because the state legislature really was, I wouldn't say controlled by the teachers' union, but never took an action that the teachers' union didn't support. and the charter schools in other states were largely non-union. So we didn't think about charters in New York, I'd say, until we'd been going for 4 or 5 years.
So your school was up and going for 4 or 5 years.
And we, this may be an accident, but we had the first lottery.
Which became the modus operandi for all charter schools. You had to, it's in the law. You have to have a lottery for people to get in.
Right.
And that was the one that Carol was talking about.
Sure.
It's after the first year. In the first year, they saw that we got the building finished, the school operated.
Carol.
When it came time to do the lottery for the second year, the people who'd been the Doubting Thomases the first year all flocked in. And then we had way oversubscribed. And
okay.
That continued.
So at what point did your building become a charter school?
Okay, the charter law passed in December of 1998. Governor Pataki wanted it done. He said he felt children in these neighborhoods should have opportunity for choice. And you probably know better than I, being in Albany, but legislators wanted a pay raise.
That's exactly right.
And there's some, but by the way the law works, they can't raise their own pay, so they have to get the raise approved for the next session.
That's right.
And I think Pataki just drew a line in the sand and said, if you want to go with a pay raise, I'm going to get a charter school bill.
He came for lunch in the city.
Came for lunch at your house?
Yes.
Okay.
Was fascinating. All kinds of guards. And sat down. We even had a strudel for him. I didn't realize until quite recently that he was actually Greek, not Greek, Hungarian. And so we had a strudel, which he cut. And he said, we're going to do this. We're going to get this done. And we're going to get this done because it's attached to a pay raise. And that's when we saw the painting on the wall. We knew it was going to happen.
So you got the law passed. We're running out of time, so I want to go very quickly now. What did you do in terms of you had a building, you had a school. At what point did this become a charter school?
Rudy Crewe, who was the chancellor at that time, was opposed to the charter school law. But he said, if we're going to have them, we're going to have good ones. So would you convert your school from what it was then to a charter school?
And so then we had to poll the parents and convince them this would be a good thing to do, even though it meant that if it turned into a bad school, it would be closed.
Was there resistance?
Yes, because there was fear. Nobody knew what we were talking about. What is a charter school? What is this going to do for us?
Mm-hmm.
How is this going to help our children? Well, you're going to have a voice. And we always insisted from the beginning that the parents have a voice in the operating of the school.
So was this the first charter school?
No.
No.
We were in the middle of an attempt to build a middle school and a community center on the property that Pfizer had given us. And we'd gotten a lot of support. We'd spent a lot of money and a lot of time. It had to be approved before we became a charter school because there was no capital money for charter schools. So Rudy Crewe said, we'll get it all straightened out, it'll be approved, and then you convert to a charter school so we could get the capital money. And then Rudy Crewe said something to Mayor Giuliani that he didn't like, and Rudy Crewe was gone. And there was a new chancellor, and that was Harold Levy. And that's a long story, but we did not get our expansion built. And by this time, I guess a year or two had passed. So we were not the first charter school.
But the first school was a risk. The community center was a second risk. Or as Joe said in the car on the way over, we made two bets. We won one and we lost the other. We won the opening of the charter school, but we never got the community center.
Now, you guys had to put a lot of money into this. You talked about the original outlay of $500,000. Pfizer puts $500,000 in. What's the continuing investment on your part?
Well, we wanted to make this a public effort, and so, but we didn't ask for money from anybody else until the school was up and running and they could see it. And we got a great deal of support from foundations in New York City who are concerned with the state of public education, and from people that we knew who shared these concerns, to individuals. And this was a big surprise to me, and I think to Carol, but probably not to you, Alan. The beneficiaries of the charter school movement were in the lower income neighborhoods, largely African American and Latino, but their legislators were opposed to charter schools because of the support from the teachers union. So this bill, which benefited all the Democrats constituencies, was put through by a bunch of right-wing Republicans.
Yeah, I know that. Mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. In New York State Legislature, I don't think we have really right-wing Republicans. We have Republicans who are right-wing compared to Democrats. But this is not a Tea Party state.
No, but the mystery to me still is, why is education a partisan issue? And nothing about what we've done seems to have changed that.
Well, you know, do you not? I mean, you've been perfectly clear in your antipathy to the fact that the regents are basically controlled and chosen by the assembly, and the money, larger amounts of money, come from the union. So that answers your question, doesn't it?
Yes. Sadly,
well,
yes.
Well, the major people who work with Pataki to get the bill passed were Republicans. And they came to us afterwards and said, this isn't going to amount to anything unless it becomes bipartisan, unless it has Democratic support.
Yeah.
And we and a lot of other people worked long and hard to move some Democrats to support charter schools.
Well, DFER, Democrats for Educational Reform, came to us. Joe said that they could hold their whole meeting in a phone booth. That's how many of them there were. That organization has now expanded and is doing a good job of trying to make a blend of these political antipathies.
Well, speaking to you guys about that, is it not true that you started an organization yourselves dedicated to helping charter schools?
That is absolutely true.
Tell us about that.
Well, we got an idea that these were schools in an incubator situation, that they were going to need some kind of overall protection if they were to survive.
Charter schools.
Charter schools. Charter schools would have to be protected. They would have to be, if not policed, watched to see that they were not cheating, that they were not committing bad practices. And so we started a center in collaboration with Joel Klein, Julian Robertson, and Robin Hood. In a week, you know the number better than I do, we got, I think it was somewhere between $40 and $50 million committed to start this charter center.
What had happened is that after the bill passed, there was still not broad-based support, and there was no support at the Board of Education. But when Mike Bloomberg became mayor, and he got mayoral control of the schools, he was in favor of competition and alternatives.
No easy thing, by the way, mayoral control of the schools. There were a lot of forces that didn't want to see that happen.
And it would never have happened under Mayor Giuliani, I don't think. But Bloomberg was able to get it, and was able, 8 years later, to get it renewed. But it had not been a happy time the first 4 years of the charter law, because you had state education department in Albany, all of those bureaucrats didn't want charter schools, and the Board of Education in New York didn't want charter schools. So that's when, as Carol mentioned, we figured we had to unite first to advocate for charter schools, second, to control the quality of charter schools, and third, to raise the public awareness of it.
Do you remember the Annenberg grant? I think the ambassador gave New York City $50 million, and it turned into a feeding frenzy. There was no over-organization that could make it be a united effort, and so it didn't work very well.
So now you have this group called the
New York City
Charter Center.
Now called the New York City. The first name we had the word excellence in it.
Took that out.
Okay, New York City Charter Center, and you hired an impressive young man to be the head of this.
And James Merriman.
Well, we first hired, he was our second leader. The first was a woman named Paula Gavin who didn't know anything about education, but was well-versed in New York City. She had run the Y's.
I see.
In New York, so she knew a lot of people up here, and she knew how to get things done. And she was the one who launched it. We realized we needed somebody who was more versed in education, and that's when we got James Merriman.
Okay, so when this is all up and running, who says it will continue to run? You know, after all of us at some point pass on.
Well, I was the original chair of this thing, and I was succeeded by a woman half my age. So that part of it is secure. I think there will be a challenge when Mayor Bloomberg leaves. We're all wondering what it will be like when Mayor Bloomberg leaves, because none of the candidates right now are speaking out strongly in favor of charter schools because they don't want the union to oppose them. So we'll have to see what happens. It was a wonderful opportunity where you had a chancellor 100% behind you and finding real estate in the existing public schools. That, by the way, was something we were first in. When we settled our middle school dispute with Chancellor Levy, he gave us space in an existing public school to put our middle school, and that was the first co-located school. That's the big battle that goes on now whenever somebody wants to start a charter school. They need to find space. And Chancellor Klein made it a practice of finding the space for charter schools. They've about run out of space now. So each square foot is a battle. And without the strong support of the mayor and the chancellor, it's going to be very difficult to get more space.
There was one charter-like school, our school, and now there are 132 which have charters.
Do you feel proud of that?
Very proud of it.
Is this your legacy?
On a good day.
And on a bad day?
I don't, because it's such a terrible battle, and it shouldn't be.
But it's interesting, Alan. This is sort of like the mouse that roared. What would you guess the percentage of New York City school children are in charter schools?
I wouldn't even guess.
Well, it's 3%.
Yeah.
So this issue of parents having an opportunity to choose where they didn't have one before, I think it was well managed. Almost all of those charter schools are in Harlem, Central Brooklyn, and the South Bronx.
Now, one of your collaborators on charter schools, Eva Moskowitz, wants to put them into neighborhoods that have more affluent people in them. What do you guys think of that?
On an equity issue,
I think she's right.
Eva's right. And that may be the next development.
Equity and equality are really not the same thing. And parents on the Upper East Side or Upper West Side still have the ability to choose.
Choose what? Between?
Where they want to send their child to school. They don't have to go to the zone school. There are enough good schools around that they can choose either to go to a public school or they can pay for a private school.
$40,000 a year.
Or more.
Yeah.
Parents who live at or below poverty don't have that choice. So our point was to provide choice to parents who didn't think they had it.
So you think on a theoretical level that Eva Moskowitz bringing charter schools into affluent neighborhoods is fair, but in fact you think there are greater priorities?
Yes, I do. I don't know if I'm getting in trouble for saying that.
I hope so.
But in the beginning, when we would ask a child, what do you want to be? They had no answer because it never occurred to them that they could be anything. Now when we ask these little kids what they want to be, they have a world full of answers, and they will say to Sonia or to me, can we be you? And the answer is yes.
Which is why you wrote the book?
Yes.
And the whole idea of the book is it becomes sort of a manual to be replicated. And we are talking about getting to Bartlett Street, Carol and Joe Rich, 25-year effort to level the playing field in education. If you read it, you're going to hear a lot of exciting stories. You're going to hear, for example, about criminality. You're going to hear about people who try to steal and of gouging and some religious groups who didn't play it quite fairly and labor coalitions and a lot of things, including something called Blob. But you have to read the book in order to get it all. Carol Rich, I thank you so much for being with us. Your background is extraordinary. Joe Rich, it proves that people can put their money where their mouths are and really make a huge difference. And I thank you both for being here.
And we thank you for letting us speak. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.